Honorable Jason Cole.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I just want to say two matters that I want to speak on. One is Section 7 in the amendments, which states that a proceeding under this act shall be commenced within 2 years after the birth of the child. Now, I strongly oppose this. I feel that if we enact this, then we're forgetting the child and the taxpayers. And many times, I feel it's unrealistic, and as a matter of fact, it's ridiculous. I'm strongly opposed to that provision. I think the purpose of these kind of statutes, of course, is to see that the child doesn't become a public charge. I feel that this is not consistent with that.
Would you recommend simply deleting that?
Yes, I'd recommend that be deleted, Mr. Chairman. And the other matter that concerns me is whether or not the welfare recovery under this act will be able to be involved in those cases as they are now. I'm not sure. But I do feel that welfare recovery should be permitted to become involved in those cases where they are servicing welfare recipients.
Does anybody know?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Peter Jackson.
Oh, all right.
The witness will tell us who he is when he
calls. Oh. I'm sorry, I apologize.
No. He's speaking about the other judge.
Oh.
We can get him to see.
Yes.
Right. Any questions, Judge Bell? No, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
This is an extremely difficult choice to make between a judge and a legislator. Very well, Judge Francis. Please come forward, take the stand.
He's my boss.
Give us your name, address, position, occupation. Tell us why you are here.
All right. My name is Carl Francis. I'm building the position like sitting.
No.
My
position is sitting. Yeah.
Well, question. You have an occupation.
Yes.
What is it?
District judge.
And where do you reside?
Dayton, Oregon, 302 Church Street.
What is the number of your district? You make
a seat. I'm here as an ex-chairman of the Family and Juvenile Law Committee of the Bar, and this is with respect to House Bill 1310. Judge Felton commented on two matters, and I'm not going to trespass too much on your time, but the act of the last legislature transferring affiliation proceedings to the circuit court. We have a family court established. Created a real problem because there was no procedural outline made at that time. And as we know, at the present time, the law that we have in Oregon, which is a rather ancient one, is quasi-criminal, provides for the institution of the proceedings in the Justice of the Peace Court or the District Court. And this by either the mother or under a section of the law, if it is likely that she become a public charge, any public officer authorized to make arrests may institute the proceedings. And there follows a proceeding with which I think we are all somewhat familiar, which is somewhat criminal in nature, but the thing akin to a preliminary examination in the lower court. And if the person charged either secures to be paid a sum, gives bond, then the matter is terminated there. Or if he doesn't do these things and there is probable cause to believe him guilty, and that's the language of the present law, he's then bound to the circuit court. And the proceedings go by the district attorney to initiate proceedings. Well, for a number of reasons, it was felt that this law had to be rewritten. The Oregon State Bar mandated the Family Law Committee to rewrite the law. My briefcase is full of the files, and I've been frightened to be asked to find something that is in it. To impress you, Mr. Chairman. I would perhaps best and most briefly explain what we attempted in our draft by reading the report which was made to the bar. And after reviewing the problem created by the 1967 Act, and the report continued saying, although professing to be civil in nature, the existing code provides for arrest, posting bail, and a form of preliminary hearing before magistrate. Only when these steps are exhausted is a case transferred to circuit court. Your committee feels that the original and exclusive jurisdiction should be in the circuit court, and all appearance of a criminal proceeding eliminated. The proposed bill makes the proceeding one in equity and eliminates the cumbersome process of a two-step hearing. It retains the requirement that the female's testimony be corroborated and that blood tests may be ordered. It eliminates any maximum limit on support and substitutes a standard analogous to that in domestic relations cases. The committee feels that the proposed bill offers a relatively simple procedure in place of a cumbersome one, and yet provides adequate safeguards for the defendant. The bill recognizes that our principal concern is the welfare of the child, and makes no attempt to compromise this responsibility as our present law does. The committee has expressed some concern that constitutional problems may develop from transferring jurisdiction from law to equity. Now, I was the one who raised that question, and so I suppose Senator Reed served me, I think it would be not unusual. And that was that there was no provision in the draft which the committee worked out calling for a jury trial. I addressed an inquiry to the chairman of the Attorney Committee of the American Bar Association. He said he was not concerned with the constitutional question. But the House, when it heard the bill, made changes. And I would like to comment upon these at this time. In the first place, the bill which was drafted by the committee provided that any of the following persons could initiate proceedings. A mother of a child born out of wedlock, or a female pregnant with a child who may be born out of wedlock. B, State Public Welfare Commission in furnishing support to the mother for the benefit of the child, or furnishing services or assistance of any kind because of the birth or impending birth of the child. C, the district attorney, or D, the duly appointed and acting guardian of the person or estate of the child, or guardian ad litem if such a person has the physical custody of the child and is providing support. Now, one of the things that concerns us is that something that Oregon may not be too proud of. In the 10 years from 57 to 67, the rate of illegitimate births in Oregon almost tripled. That from 29 per thousand to 79 per thousand. And 32,000 born in one recent year, 2,400, almost 8% were illegitimate. And the information we had was to the effect that this is something which would have to be ascertained and be more careful. That there's a percentage given there that I really don't quote because I'm not too sure of its accuracy. It's a real high percentage of the ABC caseload being where you have these illegitimate children. The House took out the provision of the Welfare Commission in the Act, and the instructions which I have from the present chairman of the committee is don't rock the boat because so much has got to be done here, and we're afraid that the adjournment will be tomorrow or the next day, that they're scared of amendments on the thing. But I do have to point out that that this was not the thinking of the committee. And and just as an anomaly, or I'll call it incongruous, our positions are, the day that this was to be heard before, and when I could not appear, I had a continuous circuit court assignment without any increase in pay. Since I had my present job, I had five show causes, welfare recovery, set that afternoon. And here where a fellow is married a gal, we have welfare recovery acting. The person who doesn't, under the present law, welfare recovery will be unable to act. Only the mother. The district attorney can only act if she wants to.
I would consider referring from the welfare to first make the request upon the mother that she had. Maybe a situation where the mother at least ought to have the opportunity of going there if she wants it. She might not want it.
Well, the point that I desire to make is that this, in a sense, was what the House did with respect to the district attorney. But where is the district attorney going to be involved now when anciently the county provided relief and there was motivation? Now it's that's a rather meaningless thing. Of course, we don't when welfare recovery is acting in these divorce cases and even simple non-support cases. You don't ask the mother whether she wants to participate in it or not. She signs a petition, but I suspect that I don't know what the circumstances are going to do about it. In any event, I want to point out that that has been deleted from the bill. Now, another issue which we had, in which we debated quite a bit, was this matter of a jury trial. But I was the only one doing the debating, so I was overruled. The House has provided that all affiliation proceedings shall be commenced in the circuit court, shall be for all purposes, and shall for all purposes be deemed suits in equity. That's section 2, top of page 3, and added that either party shall have the right to trial by jury.
Carl, is there any inconsistency between the provision that either party shall have the right to trial by jury and then the court in a private hearing?
No. Presently, we have the law presently provides that, and the present law provides the defendant may demand a trial by jury because we have this quasi-criminal proceeding, and the public is excluded, may be excluded then, and the hearing is held private. So there'd be nothing inconsistent there that I see. Now, the feeling of the committee, and I would respectfully direct the attention of this committee to section 7, appearing on page 4. The feeling of the committee was that there should be no period of limitations as to the commencement of proceedings under the Act. But if the defendant could raise a defense of laches, in other words, if someone's been sleeping on their rights, why they couldn't, they couldn't be heard. But, is that so?
I don't know. A little Mexican sense.
In any event, the House has placed a 2-year statute of limitations in there. Of course, this was the thing to which Judge Felton was addressing himself, and he talked to this committee because this does indicate that if the father could, for some reason, calm the mother into not taking any steps for 2 years today, nothing could be done. Now, there's no specific statute of limitations in the present Act. We do have a statute, but we're not familiar with it. It says that there's no other limitation expressed that the 10-year applies. But one question has been recently raised, does this mean that the guardian of that baby is going to act within 2 years of the time of birth of the child to get an action going? Generally, the rights or the procedure which existed before the present law on blood tests is preserved. The necessity of corroborative testimony is preserved. The idea is that we put this in one court of record, one proceeding, civil in nature, and with no limitations present in the law as to the amount that a person is required to contribute. The present law has a maximum of $900, which is the most father per annum may be required to contribute to the support of the child. And this would provide that that the sum deemed appropriate for the support and maintenance of the child during its minority and reasonable necessary expenses in connection with the care of the mother.
Any questions?
Mr.
Chairman?
Mr. Chairman?
What limitation should we leave? Shouldn't there be some state limitation rather than
the committee was the committee was divided, Senator. As I say, my successor to this committee wanted me to be very careful that I don't being very candid with you, excite this committee into a bunch of amendments, which may cause nothing to happen as we're in the process of adjourning. But a two-year period, pardon? Well, I don't know, but I'll tell you. I've had this happen to me where something can come from one house to the other on it in those days, and nothing happens. And so it's kind of terrifying to me.
What time element did they talk about?
Just about any time that you can think of, 6 years, 10 years. I think even there's 2 years, but I believe
7 years seems to be sort of acceptable. Thank you. Committee.
Well, I'd say
7 years seems to be sort of acceptable.
That's only for leaving foreign objects inside.
Oh,
foreign object is expelled.
Any further questions, Senator?
Well, I'd say 6 years and 10 years is an area of discussion, but they agree on the subject.
Senator Jernstein.
Yes. Well, there are a bunch of amendments that, if you'll turn to, well, I don't know how it's in your bill book, but House amendments provided that section 13. You see, we have after the sad experience of Charlie Chaplin and by Oregon initiative, Oregon and other states adopted a uniform blood test act, and so what they did was they amended that section of the law and fit it in here. And so it's taken out in one place, and then with probably better workmanship, incorporated here section 13.
The section printed in the 1969 Act, which paternity is relevant fact. I like now they bring one under section 188 and this is which paternity isn't relevant.
Well, of our committee did the job.
Careful now, my partner was the secretary.
Any further questions? You would feel then that the provision of the Public Welfare Commission initiating this should be restored and that something should be done with respect to the limitation.
I would feel, Mr. Chairman, that the committee is hopeful that the Affiliation Act is enacted, but we want on the record is distress as to the absence of the Welfare Commission and the fact that there's a two-year statute of limitations. Put that out to the language and answer your questions.
Very amorphous statement. Any further questions? Thank you very much. Yes, you may stay. Anyone else wish to appear on House Bill 1310? If not, we have another witness.
Please. Chairman, members of this committee, my name is Harold C. Hart. I'm an Assistant Chief Deputy District Attorney for Multnomah County, Oregon. I reside at 1130 Southwest 16th Avenue, Oregon. I have been a practicing attorney for the past 13 years, and since July 1, 1963, I've been a member of the Office of Public Affairs Attorney, the President of the 16th Command of the Staff of approximately 30 lawyers, and as such, I'm charged, among other things, with active prosecution of attorney cases. I've probably tried as many paternity cases as anybody in the state of Oregon. I've actively worked with the federal attorney, but Senator Burns has supplied me with a copy of the bill as amended, and I'd like to go through it, if I could, from the top and indicate, first of all, general approval in the opinion of our office of paternity court ought to be overhauled.
Is it your intention to explain what this bill does to us? That has already been done, so you can find your remarks, please, to if it's approval, why, etc. If you disagree with any portion of it, disapproval, explain that.
Thank you. That's what, that was my point.
All right.
I think that subsection D, paragraph 2 in section 1, ought to be deleted as evidentiary. That's the probable contents on page 2 of the description. Mine's on the It's a matter of evidence, in the first place. In the second place, by the time these people appear to us, it's a medical matter, and they're not really competent to say when it is they became pregnant. It's a matter that can be ascertained at the time of the trial. With regard to the statements regarding the deletion of the welfare recovery provision from the prosecution, the case of Attorney General, the statements previously made.
Is there any procedure for taking the mother's deposition?
There is under the present act, 109.150 specifically says that the rules of civil procedure shall apply to return cases, and that being the case, depositions are requested under the present act. I don't see anything in the act that's before the committee that changes
the section.
I'm speaking of the specific ORS 109.150 of the present act, and I don't see anything in this thing which deletes or modifies. Well, it repeals that, but it doesn't indicate this is an action, and that it is a civil proceeding. That being the case, it would be my assumption that the rules of civil proceeding would apply into it. On just the preceding section 2, on paragraph 3, it's the strong feeling of my office, and I think also the Welfare Recovery Department, Mr. Fujigami, will be coming up later this afternoon.
Can you excuse me, I'm sometimes a little slow. Are you aware of a case which says that with regard to affiliation for the proceedings, the general rules of civil procedure will apply absent the statute?
There are three Oregon Supreme Court decisions in which state that these are civil proceedings. One specifically holds that 9-3 verdict is appropriate as in civil cases. One specifically holds that it's not a verdict involved, but one which says the state shall have no right of appeal. And I don't have a case of performance, so that there are three cases which do say that these are civil proceedings, but they accept the decision. And the judge's formal remarks are quasi-criminal. They are civil proceedings. They are statute.
Today.
Yes.
Yeah, there is a really language that you're right.
That's right. There are also a new procedure, not something that arises directly out of the common law.
That's why I
require a statute for the basis.
They're contrary to common law. In Oregon prior to 1917, we had no apparent statute. That was the first one. Since then, it's been changed very little. It's a very archaic and ancient proceeding. We in Oregon, in our district, take the position that the present statute of limitations, for instance, is the 6-year statute of limitations because it's a legislatively created cause of action. And therefore, the statute of limitations which applies to those kinds of cases applies in paternity cases. And so our court, by that kind of judicial construction, applies 6-year statute of limitations in the moment of our cases presently.
I think Section 2 does take care of it, too. I have attached it.
With regard to the arrest of the defendant, our experience is that there are times when it's important to have a defendant arrested, particularly when the defendant is about to or may depart from the jurisdiction. There's another practical reason, and that is where the defendant is about to go into the military service. If we have what's known as a valid legal restraint, which is a warrant of arrest upon the defendant at that particular time, then they will not take him into the service until this matter has been disposed of. Otherwise, he goes into the military by draft or by volunteering, and it is beyond our jurisdiction for the purpose of prosecuting the case. Oftentimes, it will delay the case for 1 year, 2 years while he's serving on his military commitment. So I think it's important to add a section, maybe as follows: when by affidavit and such other showing as the court may require, the court has reason to believe that the defendant is about to or may depart from the jurisdiction of the court, it may issue its warrant against the person of the defendant directly to the peace officer of the state, commanding him forthwith to bring the defendant before the court to answer the complaint. We feel very strongly that we do need a warrant such in this type of proceeding for specific kinds of cases. There are also, just because of the nature of the proceedings, sometimes in a minority of cases, a high degree of reason for people to get out of the state. Once they get across the state line, they're going to jurisdiction, then we have to go after them by way of felony complaint to be able to do some of the things.
Hard to imagine they would be fighting that more.
There's one more reason. Yes. So we have to have an optional provision. We'd like to have a bill amended.
Do you have that language?
Yeah, I can read it. Yes, I have it printed. Did
you get it?
I can give it to you so you can take care of it. We also think that, and I think logically that ought to be inserted prior to section 2, subsection section 1. We agree with the committee's original suggestion that these be deemed suits in equity and no jury trials be had. From a practical experience standpoint, our outcome with regard to juries or non-jury trials is exactly the same. Our success factor makes no difference whether we apply it to the courts. Our most defendants, that is 51% or better, are already stipulated to be filed by the court in these kinds of cases. We think that it expedites the prosecution of these cases from a practical standpoint. We can try a case to the court in half a day as opposed to almost 2 days by jury trial. We also think that it's inconsistent with the suit in equity. And we think that they're basically domestic relations matters, and the domestic relations departments and judges are peculiarly well suited to trying these cases. Because of the interpersonal relationships that are involved. So we would suggest that the original bill, which really provided for the trial before the court, be reinstated. With regard to section 5, which is at line 13 on page 2, we would suggest a deletion of the sentence beginning on line 14. If the defendant admits paternity, and going clear down to the period there, on line 16, court. We think that that can be adequately taken care of by just amending line 20 by saying that if the defendant admits paternity judicially or in writing, or if the court finds from a preponderance of evidence that the defendant is the father of the child, that would take care of it. Furthermore, I don't quite understand what it means to be verified by the defendant. Generally, it's executed by the defendant and verified by a notary or someone else. Here's a verifying the verification is the term of art.
What does a plaintiff do with a normal complaint?
Well, this is the situation where, as I understand, the defendant admits paternity in writing. And it would just be my suggestion that the bill be cleaned up and the ambiguities to be removed. Move that down to paragraph 2 at line 20 by stating if the defendant admits paternity judicially, that is, if he appears before the court under oath and says, I am the father, it's a judicial admission of paternity, then that would all be needed in that case. Or if he admits it in writing, which means that if he appeared, say, in my office or the office of any attorney and admitted that he was the father, that would be sufficient.
You're not confused by what verification means. You think it's unnecessary.
I agree. That's right. I think with respect to paragraph 4, line 30, we have the power to do this request, which ought to be deleted. And I think that also at line 31, you ought to insert by interlineation the words past, present, and future support. Because our experience in these cases is that the only white chip that the defendant has to play with is the white chip of time. There's a great incentive on behalf of the defendants to delay these proceedings, because so long as they delay them, they're not required to pay support. This bill provides only for the allocation of future support and maintenance, and there's no allocation of any type of passive support, that is, support on the day of birth, as the present act has. So I think I've been taking out this benefit accruing to a defendant just by virtue of his own ability to delay the proceeding. I think that with regard to the top line is line 1 on paragraph 5, the word may ought to be changed to shall.
What page?
On page 4, line 1. It shall order the defendant to pay the reasonable cost of suit, being mandatory rather than permissive. And I think also that the allegation but not including attorney's fees ought to be deleted, because it's my impression that what's presently happening in the field of domestic relations is that all of this particular kind of case is being gravitated towards the public prosecutors or agency of bureaucratic lawyers. And what this does is take this kind of case out of the office of the private practitioner. Our office thinks that the private practitioner ought to be in. We would suggest then that once a decree is made, that is, once a decree establishing paternity is made, the court, in its discretion, may allow reasonable attorney's fees to the attorney for the mother if she's unable to pay for such attorney's fees. We think that by doing that, we will bring the private sector of the bar back into this area and we will recognize where it belongs. At the present time, lawyers think that we're taking the support out of the mouths of the children in any kind of these cases and consequently they refer to the agents of lawyers. With regard to Section 7, which is the imperative limitation, we think that it either ought to be deleted or ought to be specific. Otherwise, we're going to be faced with a defense of latches in every case, because latches is an equitable defense and it's subject to the court's subjective feelings in determining what constitutes latches. I think the committee's suggestion of 7 years is reasonable. At the present time, we're operating under a 6-year statutorily created statute of limitations, statutorily created by statute. Our recommendation here would either be to delete it, in which case the court would probably do as they are now, or put in a 7-year or better statute of limitations. Other than that, we are in general accord with the bill and certainly with the necessity of enacting a new statute of limitations.
Why did the House adopt it?
Well, I was not president of the House, and it wasn't because Senator Burns has notified me of this committee meeting that I've managed to get down here. I've been trying to keep it in touch with him, but I'm stuck with other work.
Any further questions?
I also might add that I've tried acting as ex officio member of the State Bar Committee by letter to the State Bar, because of my other committee assignments.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That is the last witness. We'll now turn to House Bill 1836 and Representative Bowles.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, summary has no relationship to the bill as printed. The amendment came about by the fact that Judge Jones, a member of the legislature, brought a group of addicts to the House Public Health Committee to testify on several of the other drug bills. These people were not only ex-addicts, but they were people who were still addicts. And they testified before our committee for the large. It was very impressive, particularly in talking to some of the high school and junior high school students afterwards. They were extremely impressed by this. And the almost universal attitude of the young people was simply that the president's program to describe the problems with drugs, which consists mostly of talks by teachers or movies that are presented, are simply ineffective to the young people. They want to hear from somebody who really can tell it like it was, tell it like it is. Yeah. And as such, why this was the thought working with Ken Gaber came to our minds that we could form this type of a committee. This committee will be actually five committees, which are the five areas that cover the state drug and alcohol section of the mental health division. Each one of these will form teams of varying personnel from time to time, whose specific job will be to visit high schools and junior high schools for the purpose of conducting seminars with the students. Another thing that interested me in this area. We spent 2 days at Damage Hospital and also Oregon State Hospital wards and these people that were associated with these drugs, particularly the hallucinogens. And we found out there that there are approximately 20 people under treatment at all times for hallucinogen problems, from bad trips, freakouts, the rest of the sort of symptoms that go with people that can't handle this. The average age of the person in the Damage Hospital, Oregon State Hospital, for this problem is between 18 and 19 years of age. Generally, the earliest is about 12 or 13 that they're up with, but it peaks between 18 and 19. Subsequent to that, they seem to go on heart narcotics and off hallucinogens. Another interesting thing was that these people, all that we talked to, this was corroborated by Dr. Gaber and by the people in the hospitals, were that these people that were there on bad trips from LSD and amphetamines had absolutely no desire and showed no evidence that they were going to quit. 99% of them said as soon as they were out, they were going back on this, that they were having fulfilled a need. The bill appropriates $17,500, which is down from the original appropriation. Ways and Means found out through Dr. Haver's office there will be federal funds available, at least enough to match this fund to make $35,000, possibly more, to get this program going and started. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Any questions?
I have one. This establishes a committee of present users or those who've been rehabilitated, and you put them together on a committee.
Pretty soon they all.
Well, if they're on probation or parole for having been convicted of any crime involving the use of narcotics, one of the conditions of probation or parole is going to be that they associate with no one who has any record with regard to drugs or is known to use drugs. They're going to say you can't associate with anybody who's a drug user or has any record.
These people will be under direct supervision of personnel trained in this from the Department of Mental Health.
Well, I'm not arguing whether it's dangerous for them to be together or not, except that their parole could be revoked for that reason, or their probation could be revoked for that reason, and they would violate them. I think
it's interesting when Judge Jones brought this group down, he had one such individual with him. It was paroled from a life sentence for an armed robbery and attempted murder. And he was with this group, and his testimony perhaps was the most revealing, because even though he knew that if he continued to use drugs, he would be sent to prison under a life term, he sat there and he rolled up his sleeves and said, "But I can't quit." And so I assume that Judge Jones, before he brought this person down, along with other persons who had kicked the drug habit, probably researched that part of the law and found out it was all right for him to associate with this type of relationship. And was instructed.
This question then wasn't raised at all. I don't think he's going to get his probation revoked for being a certain judge.
He was there, though, with other addicts and other ex-addicts.
He'd always get permission.
Yeah, I think he could get permission. I just wondered if the problem had been discussed.
Any further questions, Mr. Representative? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
1515.
First witness is Mr. Hank. Governmental Park Library.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Joseph Hank, and I'm a lawyer with the Bureau of Governmental Research at the University of Oregon, UD. I'm here at the request of League of Oregon Cities to speak in favor of House Bill 1515 as amended. The interest of our office in this legislation can be traced back over a year when we were requested to do a study of the effects on the availability of tort liability insurance for governmental bodies after enactment of the governmental tort liability law last year. As a result of that study, it became evident that certain improvements could be made in the existing law, which would clarify the provisions and facilitate the purchase of liability insurance. Therefore, we drafted what became House Bill 15, which, as introduced, was sponsored by the League of Oregon Cities Association of Oregon Counties and the Association of Oregon School Boards. As you can see, substantial amendments were made by the House Judiciary Committee. However, the League of Oregon Cities feels that the amended bill still can make substantial improvements in the law and supports it in its amended form. I would like to go through it briefly and point out the principal changes that would be made under the amended bill. First of all, on page 2, in amending section 30.265, in the amended form, the bill would add immunity for both for public bodies and public officers and employees and agents. One, arising out of riot, civil commotion, or mob action. And two, in cases where an employee in good faith acts under a law that later turns out to be invalid. I think these are both desirable provisions which would improve the law. With respect to the liability limits, which are provided in ORS 30.270, language is included which is intended to clarify the application of those limits, but not to make a substantive change. I believe that this change in language will facilitate the purchase of liability insurance by local governments and will avoid certain problems in litigating cases. The House Judiciary Committee changed the time limit from 45 days to 180 days for private claims. I believe that this is an equitable provision and is in line with the claim time limits in other states. The bill also would change the provision for the person or persons with whom claims could be filed. The existing law leaves it somewhat vague as to who the appropriate person is to help them file claims with. Finally, there are a number of changes which are made to clear up or eliminate conflicting legislation. ORS 3320 appeared to be in conflict with the law as it was enacted in the last session, and it has changed to bring it into line with the tort liability law.
Where are you talking about now?
We're at page 6 of the printed bill, ORS 3.320, line 10. In addition, ORS 221.924, which provided for immunity for certain cities because of liability arising out of conditions of public places, has been repealed, or would be repealed, which is consistent with the new act. Also, in the amended form, the Judiciary Committee has provided for repeal of three other sections, which presently limit the liability of counties, of Multnomah County, for liability resulting on bridges across the Willamette River. Another section limits the liability of counties on for claims arising out of conditions of county roads to $10,000. And the third appears to limit the liability of the State Highway Department to $500 on claims arising out of conditions on the state highways. And the appeal of all of these provisions are consistent with the purpose of the bill and appear to be appropriate. I can please answer your questions if I can.
Mr. Trent, do you say the League of Oregon Cities support this bill?
Yes, sir.
Where they kick up any fuss about eliminating lines 32 and 34 on page 6, and then the first 5 lines on the top of page 7.
No, this was actually was part of our own draft of the bill. We felt we didn't act on behalf of the counties or the state, but it was drafted for the cities. And that provision only applies to cities which were incorporated under the 1893 Incorporation Act. And I understand there still are some, but most of them now derive their authority from charters that were enacted under the provisions of the Constitution since that time. So its application was quite limited, and it was inconsistent to allow this area of community for those cities and not for others.
Any further questions? No, thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Mr. Hart. Got him on the long bill. Very well, that concludes the bills that we have.
Mr. Chairman, may I speak on 1515?
Yes, sure. Were you signed up?
No, sir, I didn't get here in time to sign.
That is certainly a welcome.
Thank you. Kurt Engelstad, Association of Oregon Counties. Great, Mr. Chairman, we're in general accord with the provisions of 1515 as it applies to the improvements in the Governmental Tort Liability Act. However, we do object to the repeal of ORS 368-940 and 382-320, which Mr. Hayden referred to. 368-940 limits the liability for tort claims arising from county roads at $10,000. 382-320 limits the liability for tort claims arising from Multnomah County's bridges across the Willamette River at $2,000. These two sections were obviously not included in the 1967 Act. And we feel that there's a valid public policy consideration involved in retaining these limits, as well as repealing them. We ask you to consider both as you deliberate on this bill. With the repeal of the sections that you have the amendments before you, the liability limits for tort claims against public agencies would be uniform for all governmental torts except those for which public bodies specifically remain immune. This is the public policy question which was resolved by the House Judiciary Committee and adopted the amendments to repeal the three sections to which they referred. We feel that there is also a policy question of public value of the county road system throughout the state and how the proposed repealers would affect this system. Our concern stems somewhat from a 1967 Lincoln County Circuit Court case which was not taken up in the appeal, where Lincoln County was held liable in a tort claim action arising from an accident which occurred on one of the county roads. It is our layman's view that the plaintiff prevailed in the case in part because the road upon which the accident occurred was found to be too narrow, the condition of which the county had prior notice. This road happened to be located in a mountainous terrain used by log trucks, although a log truck was not involved in the particular accident, nor was the county vehicle. Because of its limited road funds, Lincoln County could not proceed to widen the road, and was at one time seriously considering the closure of the road to safeguard against the additional litigation that might arise from other actions. There are two points of interest with regard to county roads that usually are involved in this basic policy consideration. First, the Bureau of Public Roads established more rigorous standards for all roads which are constructed with federal funds, thus increasing their cost and also enhancing their safety. And our counties are striving to meet these standards. Their ability to meet these standards and road needs in general bring to our second point, and that is the Oregon State University's Transportation Research Institute study on road needs. That report shows that counties will need more than $1 billion in additional revenue to bring existing county roads up to standards over the next 20 years. And that report also includes the needs for the Multnomah County's bridges over the land. It is our view that the increase of the liability limits, which would be affected by the repeal of ORS 368-940 and 382-320, would further encumber the efforts of counties to improve their road systems. A valid argument can be made for the variance of limits set by the three statutes proposed to be appealed. These limits are the other one we haven't mentioned, is the state highway, actions occurring on state highways, liability limit there of $500, $10,000 for county roads, and $2,000 for Oklahoma County bridges. And the mind was to consider amendments to these statutes to set a uniform limit, perhaps of $10,000, would be lower than the general limit.
Any questions?
The repeal of 368, planning 40, in that case, the person is entitled to recover irrespective of negligence. That's where the injury occurs on the road.
Yes, sir. Well, I suppose it could. I had some discussion with this Mrs. Schlegel. I suppose then you get into the general common law area where the burden of proof would be on the plaintiff to show or to show negligence.
All right. I think, we amended that. One time it was $1,500.
Yes.
I think they got it up to $5,000, then got it up to $10,000. And my recollection was that just the mere fact that you got hurt on the road, you were entitled to recover. You got to,
there had to be a defect.
I think you put in that the county clerk didn't know about it, but at one time, even if they didn't know about it, they could recover.
You didn't have to prove notice to the county court originally, but you had to prove that there was a defect in the road.
Center of kind of strict liability aspect of
that, and they had a limited amount of time.
Yeah.
Yes, I know that the latest amendment to that section was made at our request to raise it to $10,000, with the language.
Well, you want those repealed or not?
Well, we do not. Otherwise, in the general report of the bill, our request, along with the meeting of the school board, I think does improve the general aspects of the
Any further questions?
No, thank you.
What's the number of the other bill? Okay, that concludes the hearings. Let's turn to Senate Bill 193. Yes? Well, I want to say something first. We received a note from, well, here are the amended 193.
Chairman? You mean you had 1229 listed? I don't know whether you here to do that or not.
No, actually, here it is. 1229 is the unordered goods. We already passed a bill, Senate Bill 106. Well, I think the committee should know it. And I neglected to explain it. We passed a bill, the same bill as this, Senate Bill 106. So I talked to the Senate Committee, the House Judiciary Chairman. And we agreed that we would table this and they would pass the bill that we already had. Somebody moved to table House Bill 1229.
I so moved.
Call the roll.
Aye.
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 Megan.
Aye.
Pleasant.
Aye.
Jim Smith.
Aye.
Lynn.
Aye.
Kay.
Aye.
Norman.
Aye.
Aye.
Table. Mr. Chairman, this is highly irregular. I'm watching you know,
yes,
missed out at this paternity hearing. I was in Portland. I didn't hear about it until yesterday. The still that concerns the Paternity Act?
We had Carl Francis, Judge Felton, and Harold Hart, who testified on it at considerable length. Walter, if you want to add anything, we'd be glad to hear you. But
at certain meetings, I would like you to just make a statement.
All right, you better make it now, then, because this will be your last opportunity.
Thank you very much, sir. I apologize for the I'm one of the chief nominees, the author of the government, and the chief counsel. And the interest that I have stems from the fact that our department processes 30 to 40 of these welfare cases, each one, and we can probably get to 120 cases in the course.
Do you have one attorney that's assigned to that full time?
No, we have seven attorneys in the office, and we can serve the case of bound up. As we come up, I do cancel one of them. As I read the changes were made from the recommended bill that the bar committee presented at the meeting, here at those committee meetings, so when the bar committee came up to the case, it seems that the responsibility of the bar committee might be changed a little bit in regards to the processing of these cases. Now, as far as the department's concerned, we don't care. In fact, most of the staff would probably be happy to be down the process of these cases. They're a headache and daughter and settled wise.
I don't want
to. The terms, the meeting monetary terms, are to take on a couple of people. But on the long run, we think there are cases that ought to be processed by someone. And as I understand it, I haven't seen the changes itself. Welfare up here, and like I said, if they wanted that portion of the meeting, which showed that the welfare commission could present to them, this tied in with the provision later on, which said in public interest cases, the district attorney's office and the recovery division computer was changed, and the recovery division was deleted from that public interest was to initiate these cases. Now, taking these two things together, it seems to just eliminate the recovery division from this type of activity, which is fine. But I think a couple of things that always were brought out in this bank, which I hope were presented to this with our consideration by the pass on this bill. First of all, illegitimacy is all and the welfare position seems to be based on the assumption that the woman is the only one that should have the right to initiate this proceeding. I submit that the child's interest is a paramount thing that the public ought to be concerned with. And a lot of times the woman really doesn't know what she wants. She's confused, she's embarrassed, she's helpless, and she needs guidance most of all. If somebody doesn't prompt her or if it takes an interest in this case, it's going to go on. And this tied in with a 2-year statute of limitations, which I think is going to apply, is going to wash out a great number of criminal cases.
Election and
the statute of limitations?
Yeah.
I think the bill as it was originally written was matters in that Latches wasn't effective. Latches.
What he's saying is no statute of limitations directly.
No specific
facts,
Chairman. And if there is one, it ought to be 7 or 10 years.
What would you think of taking the bill when the House passed it and making only 2 amendments, restoring the right of public welfare to initiate, changing statute of limitations from 2 years to 6 years, and passing it?
I think this would be very good. 2 years.
How many years did you say?
6. I discussed that with Judge Francis, and that's his recommendation. Us, is that we do make these 2 changes. And we can get it out here today so it's a chance to make it for us.
2 years is something else.
All right ahead, Waller.
On the 2 year statute, most of our cases are over 2 years old. The woman in 2 years doesn't know what she wants. We're probably getting confused. But if we don't change this, a lot of these cases are going to go by the board, and certain benefits that are due to the child, social security benefits, in the accident benefits, matching benefits, army allotments, these things all come into play towards the total resource that this child has with support. And as it stands now, if it goes through the way the changes were added, as I understand it, I would read it to mean that we're going to borrow on the picture. That's all right with us. I just thought that these points ought to be considered. And, certainly, welfare's proposition, in a nutshell, is directly, I think, against the federal thrust as set out by Mr. Bannon, who is the ranking official of the Council of Human Welfare. In June of last year, we had a conference, and I just want to read one paragraph, one sentence from his statement, which seems to be contrary to what the welfare academic said to this committee earlier. And Mr. Bannon said, quote, the welfare agencies are to initiate action to establish paternity for children born out of wedlock receiving systems. and that this is not only essential to the collection of support from the father and child, but also helps to establish the child's legal rights in other respects, and it makes it social security, benefits, probate, benefits, and these things. So, I feel that welfare should take an active interest in certain cases, and should have the right to initiate these actions if it's so.
Thank you, Walter. The other witnesses made the same recommendation. Thank you very much. With respect to 193, I would like to say, first, let there be any misunderstanding. Regardless of what amendments we adopt or do not adopt today, the bill will come up on the floor for vote at the same time. That's number one, because we'll show these amendments, if any, adopted today as having been done before. That's agreeable to me. Yeah.
Sure.
Second, Kathleen Beaufay gave us a note which says that in 193, as we passed it out, that the definition of a hospital means a hospital licensed under Chapter 441, which has a full-time staff of physicians. She said Representative Carruthers says this definition would restrict the hospital to medical schools. No other hospitals have full-time staff. Kathleen Beaufay suggests substitution for the underlying language above, the following, quote, but not including nursing homes or convalescent homes, end quote, which she says was the intent of Senator Hoyt. All right, so then that is her suggestion with respect to this. Subsequent to that, Senator Wilner came to me and informed me that when we acted upon this bill for amendments of the last meeting, when he was asked to explain the differences between the majority report of the subcommittee and what we referred to as 193 MACA, that he overlooked an amendment with respect to consent being given. Earlier today, just before the meeting, he showed me his amendments, and I suggested that the written consent, which is required, I pointed out, guy might be in the Army, he might be in Timbuktu, you don't know where he is, that in that situation, perhaps something should be done. And he amended his own proposed amendments to provide that the written consent of the husband must be obtained only if they are living together as man and wife. Now, what is the wish of the committee? The chairman is willing to do whatever you want with respect to sending the bill to the floor as it is or indicating further amendments, doing what you wish.
Question.
Senator Dierenstedt.
Aren't a couple living together as man and wife, even if he's in the Army?
If they weren't living together in that situation, I imagine if he was in the Army, they would be considered as being living together. Might be some weakness there.
Yeah. When
Senator,
when 193 be on the floor?
The earliest that it can be on the floor is, did you say Monday? Monday morning.
Chairman, I want, as soon as it can be done, I know that any amendments we do now, we can get to Council to be done right away. I thought that these consents were in the Hoyt Bill. As you remember, I listed them. I was asked by the chairman what the points of difference I thought they'd been there. I would like to see us put in this language. No pregnancy shall be terminated without the written consent of the pregnant woman. See, even that's not in there now. She might be going for an operation or something else and discover that.
What if she is in critical condition, unable to get
it? No, the emergency clause calls that. And, A, the written consent of a parent who has custody or the guardian of the pregnant woman is an unmarried minor. B, the written consent of the guardian of the pregnant woman is judicially declared a mentally incompetent person. C, the written consent of the husband if the pregnant woman was married and the husband and wife are living together. Two copies of the consents required under this section shall become part of the hospital record. Representative White showed me his bill not too much before that other meeting. I assume this was in here. Also, there's one other completely technical thing. On the bottom of the middle of page 3, where it says section 4 of this act, it should say, why is unable to comply with this act? Remember, we changed that in every other place. Mr. Chairman, I would move that we
Now, have we formally voted out?
Yes, this bill has been formally voted out.
I move to reconsider the vote by which we voted out, and I advise the committee that I propose to, if it's reconsidered, to make the motion that Captain McVeigh said, the motion that I just said on consents, and this technical thing that I just mentioned, and then propose to move right out and do that.
I'd like to have discussion on that before the motion is entertained. Senator McKay?
Well, I don't know, maybe we should also put on here that each time we should have a vote of people on each individual case.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Burns?
I want you to know that I construe the environmental clause, which is the Scandinavian approach, as essential, making this bill essentially no different than the Roberts bill, because there's no criteria laid down here in the environmental clause for determining the grounds and reasons for performing the abortion. And I can't see, as long as that's in there, I can't see really any difference between this bill and the Roberts bill. So if we reconsider it, I'm going to have a motion made with respect to that environmental
clause. Just so the others understand, it's apparently laid down. It's laid down before it's law. I have no objection to that clause the way it's written, because the way I interpret this, it does not mean that. The way I interpret this, and I've been very worried about this, since this language was in there, this thing says it's not the fourth round of abortion, but it is what the doctor shall, one of the factors the doctor may consider in determining the substantial risk of greatly impairing the mental health of the mother. I discussed this morning with Dr. Rose, who is the state board of health member assigned to work on this development. She tells me that that is her construction. She thinks that's the state board of health's construction. She's writing me a letter that will say that. I had originally thought that that might be made clear by putting it up to member A, but I'm satisfied that that's that whether it's in A or whether it's in 2 and referring only to A, that I think it's the same effect. So if this bill, if 2 was a backdoor of doing the Roberts bill, I would have not been for. I do not think 2 the way it's putting it on that record.
I don't agree, and if what Senator Miller says is correct, then it's unnecessary to have Section 2 there, and if it's complete surplus in there, we can just as well be eliminated. I think this. Some of us disagree sincerely and very strongly with respect to this issue. The subcommittee worked, perhaps not in a complete spirit of harmony, but I think did some work, came up with a bill that probably I voted against the subcommittee, probably I gave it support. It goes no further than any of the other states, the other 7 states that have enacted a new abortion ordinance. But it goes a lot further, really, than the other 43 states. But I just don't agree with the interpretation of that. Those of you that are interested in getting this, it seems like it's an all or nothing thing. We plan to have nothing, maybe we'll have nothing.
But let's pass the thing. In favor of consent, I thought that was in there.
I'd like to ask a question. Did I not hear what Senator Hoyt wants done with the bill? Didn't he have some amendments he wanted?
Hoyt wants it brought back.
But what for?
That isn't what Hoyt told me.
For this amendment, I understand.
That bill can be amended.
Hoyt informed me just before we adjourned today that as far as he is concerned, he'd like to have the bill go out as it is. I mean, I think that's technical.
Did he have some amendments in mind that he wants in the House? What were his amendments, is what I'm trying to find out.
Actually, Hoyt would have no objection if this amendment were put in. the full-time hospital staff position. But I think that's,
Mr. Chairman, on this consent, as I said, I will get back to the consent, and I thought it was there. As a matter of fact, the first time I discovered they were not in the bill, the following day, somebody questioned me, what happened to them, and I said, they're in the bill. He said, they're not, and I looked for them. I will provide the fifth vote to get this bill out, just the way it sits with these three changes, the void technical change, the section four, which I think is just inadvertent, which is clearly in our motion, and the consents, which I thought were, and I think you have more chance of passing the bill on the floor with the consents. Nothing else, the consent of the vote.
Is there any further discussion?
Well, have we moved to reconsider the motion?
I
motion.
Have some.
Well, I know, but that hasn't been.
Well, point of order, did you vote on for the outside?
Yes.
You did vote to consider the bill.
Yes, yes. Call the roll on reconsideration.
Burns?
Oh, God. Come back to me.
Ivers?
Aye.
Fagan?
No.
Hudson?
Aye.
Jernigan?
No.
Lynn?
No.
Kay?
No.
Wilman?
Aye.
Mr. Chairman?
Aye.
Can we put the consent in, John? Mr. Chairman, I now move the amendment. Sorry, wait.
What was the vote?
5-4.
Favor?
Reconsider? Yes. All right, now, Mr. Chairman, I now move the amendment that the chairman read, the Kathleen Buffet amendment.
Let's take them one at a time. That one first.
I don't have more than
it's here. To insert in lieu. Well, to add quick, but not including nurses and convalescent homes.
I move to take up the nurse which has a full-time staff position.
Yeah.
Replace that. I move that change.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion is carried.
Mr. Chairman, I next move that.
Who voted in favor of reconsideration?
I did.
Okay, that's enough.
Mr. Chairman, I move that a new section 7 be added and the latest section be amended, renumbered to provide. Section 7, 1. No pregnancy shall be terminated without the written consent of a pregnant woman and A. The written consent of a parent who has custody or the guardian of the pregnant woman is an unmarried minor. B. The written consent of the guardian if the pregnant woman has been judicially declared a mentally incompetent person. C. The written consent of the husband if the pregnant woman is married and the husband and wife are living together. Two copies of the consents required under this section shall become part of the hospital record.
Discussion. I'd like to ask a question. What about the point that was raised by Senator Jernstedt? Husband and wife, husband in Manila.
Tim Buckley.
In the Army.
Let me say from my point of view, I am much more really concerned with the mother's written, the pregnant woman's written consent, the minor and the incompetent. If it's necessary to change this, that's fine with me. I'm very concerned with that.
We should amend your...
I'll set my agenda.
Why? You got to turn me down. You got to talk to me. Living together doesn't really have a legal meaning.
No.
I think there's some problems there.
Should we strike that subsection?
I don't think we're going to get any out, but that causes a few problems.
I would like to. You want to strike that subsection?
Well, I think the man has that. He's married. The woman has an absolute right.
You want to say the written consent of the husband and the pregnant woman is married.
That's what I think.
But you want to provide something, what if it's absolutely unavailable?
If he's unavailable, that's one thing.
That's what I mean. What if they're occupying the same residence or something?
I'm not going to have a necessity of C, not just
C.
I did just
what I just read C is the husband's consent. That's a problem. I'm very concerned about the written consent of a pregnant woman. I'm very concerned about parent for minor and guardian for incompetent. The other presents impossible drafting problems. I have no objection to somebody else.
I think we can take care of it. You say if they have been living together, I think that's about as good as we can do. There's a presumption about legitimacy of the statutes as well.
That would be better if they have been living together.
I think a judge would, if the question ever arose, a judge would construe that to be an exception.
I certainly would accept that. Can I accept that motion?
Yes, it's part of your motion.
That's my motion then, as just been reading to be fine.
You've heard the motion. Do you all understand it?
All right. S and a new subsection on the section 7, is that
new
right?
New section 7, and renumbers thereafter.
Well, how about 2?
We read the section 7, it becomes section 8.
Oh, wait a minute. Oh.
Shall I read it again?
Yes, please do.
You know it has a copy of section 7. Section 7.1, no pregnancy shall be terminated without the written consent of the pregnant woman, and A, the written consent of a parent who has custody or the guardian if the pregnant woman is an unmarried minor, B, the written consent of the guardian if the pregnant woman has been judicially declared a mentally incompetent person, C, the written consent of the husband if the pregnant woman is married and the husband and wife have been living together. 2, copies of the consents required under this section shall become part of the possible record.
Any discussion? Call the roll on the motion.
Hudson?
Aye.
Jernigan?
Aye.
Lynn?
Okay.
Aye.
Wilner?
Aye.
Aye.
Mr. Chairman?
Carried.
This, I think, is purely technical.
Can I ask a question? Presently, in order for a minor child to have an operation, the parents' consent is required. Is that a fair statement?
Pretty risky for hospital to do that. Mr. Chairman, this is, I think, purely technical. Above on page 3 of the rules that's before us, strike out the word section 4 of. That was.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
Mr. Chairman, I move that 193 be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended.
Any further discussion?
Mr. Chairman, I move, Senator, to amend that motion to delete subsection 2 of section 3 on page 2.
That's to take into consideration of the requirement.
Yeah. You all understand the motion? You wish to discuss it anymore?
No, you know.
Call the roll.
Burns?
Aye.
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 David?
No.
Hudson?
No.
Jernigan?
No.
Lance?
No.
No.
Wilner?
No. Aye. Motion's defeated. Senator Wilner moves the bill out as amended. Call the roll.
No. Ivor?
No.
Haley?
No.
Hudson?
Aye.
Jernigan?
Aye.
Lance?
Aye.
McKay?
Aye.
Wilner?
Aye.
No. Carry. Who wants to carry the bill?
Bitcoin.
Sign it to Bitcoin. Now we have a few other items. 1664, the bookmaking bill. You may be excused.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I move that the bill was sent to the room, so we didn't carry it on the floor the other night. Unfortunately, we were out here. The meeting here turned back to the floor with the recommendation.
One question.
Well, that sounds suspect.
Senator Glenn, one question. You are you willing to take the risk of having Senator Wilner carry it?
Yes.
Well, you have
a call the roll, 1664. Bookmaking.
I think it would just be insulting to overrule the mayonnaise. I think it would be probably just like
I didn't do the check down. We don't have any real reasons for it. We're not going to change that bill.
I had 2 or 3 bills that I voluntarily sent or asked me for the criminal arbitration commission. We've done that with a number of criminal law bills.
particularly in 1965, you made the DA's office where they had every reason to believe that what Multnomah County was making in the end of that profit that had ties with gambling all over the country, and they thought it was a major aspect of syndicated crime. If you only had a maximum $500 fine, it looks like a civil license. This bill gives discretion to Representative Ryan Kane over the judge of Park and all the headphones are going to be heard. I think they're going to get
back out. I prosecuted every gambling case in Multnomah County for 3 years. And I think that it would be an understatement to say Mr. Park.
We were told that the attorney Van Hoomerson also.
I don't think that's true.
Paul Fino of New York says
I both include both of them.
You're crazy, this guy. Call her old.
Okay.
On what?
On Chris Middleton and Bill. Do pass, 1664. Burns votes, I don't know.
You've heard the vote.
Aye. Either of them.
Aye.
Bailey.
Aye.
Hudson.
Aye.
Grinstead.
Aye.
Lynch. McKay. Willard.
Aye.
Aye. Having gotten religion, I changed my vote to aye. And Senator Wilmer carries it. Senator Miskell, what was that bill that you had amendments on? 1797. Would you come forward and John and make sure whatever you want to do for our
amendments?
Oh, I beg your pardon. The bills are amended immediately behind you. You will find the amendment.
I think it does, but puts it down to 2 years and no event over 1797.
So it now reads as follows. An action to recover damages for injuries to each person arising from any medical, surgical, or dental treatment, omission, or operation shall be commenced within 2 years. I see it down, not over 7. I hear a motion to adopt the amendment. You've heard the motion and the discussion. All those in Senator Lane.
This includes taking out the house language down in subsection 1.
Yes.
Yeah.
Call the roll.
This is the only change.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, I didn't hear the testimony on this, but there's a recent Supreme Court case in the last 2 years of the process. And this confines the process.
We kind of thought that the statute that we had agreed on 2 years ago should have covered that case, but Coleman said it wasn't a foreign substance. We rejected something. So.
Senator Lent wanted us to keep this 2 years. I'll roll on the amendments.
Burns.
Aye.
Aye. Bailey.
Aye.
Hudson.
Aye. Didn't really do that.
McKay. Wilmer.
Aye.
Mr. Chairman.
Aye. Who moves to pass the amendment?
Aye.
Senator Burns moves. Call roll.
Burns.
Iver.
Aye.
Hayden.
Aye.
Hudson.
Aye.
Jernigan.
Aye.
Lynch.
Aye.
McKay. Willen.
Thank you very much.
No, but I will. I'll tell you, I just soon have somebody else do it. I'm getting a lot of mail. Are you? Hey, why don't you carry it?
Yes.
All right, Senator Fisher. Now, what other bills did we hear last meeting?
I've got a little one. We may have passed it out or down. I'd like to vote on it.
Oh, here we are.
It's passed over to Dan.
1542.
What is that?
Mentally deficient.
What number, please?
1542. And here are the amendments. Well, I'll pass them around. On page 2, line 15, delete a reasonable.
These conform with your charge?
Yes. And on page 2, line 16, after the period, insert, quote, "The attorney fee shall be fixed by the court and shall be paid on the same basis as fees for attorneys appointed in criminal cases from the circuit court."
I move it.
Heard the motion? We have call roll. All in favor say aye.
Charge!
Opposed, no. Motion's carried. Senator Wilner moves. Bill has to pass as amended.
I do.
Call the roll.
Burns.
Aye.
Hyder.
Aye.
Hayden.
Aye.
Husband.
Aye.
Transfer.
Aye.
Lynn.
Aye.
Kaye Wilner.
Aye. Senate Bill 1562.
House Bill.
Who
need an amendment to that?
Well, here they are. I'll pass them around.
Four to the left, three to the right. Is this an error of committee? Discussion grant, which you need.
Where did she like it? I haven't read the bill. I tend to agree with you. There's only one great anomaly relating to this, and that is that failure to leave the scene of a felony hit and run carries a 5-year sentence, whereas negligent homicide carries a 3-year sentence on the upside. They're both entitled to misdemeanor. And sometime these should be brought into alignment, but I don't think they have way a lot of issues.
They're not really adding. They get down here and they get sort of a half-ass restate 492 definition of gross negligence. They think it's going to help.
They get spelling on
No.
Yes, you heard about the
VAS. Half VAS.
Some ideas are VAS, some ideas are half VAS.
You know, Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, I was going to say it's a hell of a lot better to be entertaining ideas from a man who's only half-assed.
I was going to say that Lent reminds me of the mighty Columbia, and look what's happened to it after all its power has been harnessed.
Full sludge.
Mr. Chairman, did you know what happened when the lady married the astronaut?
No.
9 months later, they had a half-astronaut.
Small astronaut.
All right.
Is there a motion to refer this to the criminal law commission?
Yes.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Carried. Notice about 1636. Look at 1636. Here are amendments.
Bill.
Oh, now there's a... What do you want to do with the Belton Hamilton amendments? I'll hand them to you. There you are, John. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion is carried. Do you make that the final step, Senator Fagan?
Yes.
Senator Fagan moves out to pass as amended. Call the roll. Senator Husband, the chairman assigned you a very important task of trying to report to this committee whether or not we should concur with the House amendments to Senate Bill 188
on corporation.
On corporation.
Oh, yes.
Are you prepared?
Yes, yes.
What do you want to do with 1310, affiliation proceedings?
I move we restore the language, the legal language on the State Public Welfare Commission, change 2 to 6 on the tax limitations.
Mr. Chairman, we handled those separately.
No amendments?
I would support the first one.
No, wait, I would support the increase in statute. But I'm not so sure that it's a good idea to have the
Senator Burns has asked for a division of the question. We'll first vote on whether or not to increase the statute of limitations from 2 to 6 years, changing section 7 on page 4, line 10, the word 2 to 6.
Now that's on part.
No, affiliation proceedings.
Oh, affiliation, all right.
All favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion is carried. The question now is on restoring. We don't need that district attorney because that's lower down. Restoring the language in lines 10 through 13 on page 1, namely the allowing the Public Welfare Commission to initiate these proceedings. Call the roll on that amendment.
Anyway, his amendment is to restore it, so it's your point to what I guess.
Yes.
All right.
No.
All the other good people testified, of course.
I'm going to vote aye.
Bailey?
No.
Hudson?
Aye.
Greenstead?
Aye.
Lansing? Wilmer?
Aye.
Aye.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Wilmer, move to fill out the pass.
Yes.
Can
we
make a motion? Yes.
I would move to page 3 of the bill. I mean, 31. After the word the, past and.
He has no trouble with the sounding.
That's the
answer. Past and future. You heard the as a good amendment.
Yes.